The date is the 19th of August 2015. My name is Carmen Asiam Cook. I'm here with Sonia Livingston in 32 Lincoln's Inn doing an oral history recording as part of the 120th anniversary of LSE. Sonia, can you state your full name for me and your date of birth?
Yes, I'm Sonia Mary Livingstone, and I was born on the 30th of April 1960.
Sonia, when did you first come to LSE?
I was appointed in October 1990, so 25 years ago.
What did you first think of campus when you first saw it?
What did I first think of campus? I was just, I think, very glad to have an office as a young academic. It felt quite small and contained, but that was good because I could find my way around a bit. It was fantastic being in the centre of London. My previous job had been on the edge.
And what did you come here to do when you first arrived?
I arrived as a young lecturer in the Department of Social Psychology.
And is that what you taught when you first arrived?
Yes, I taught social psychology. I'd done my PhD in social psychology. I've always moved a bit between psychology and sociology. And the Department of Social Psychology then, and indeed now, is a very kind of interesting hybrid of sociological and psychological approaches to social psychology and rather kind of deliberately trying to set out a particular approach to how psychological dimensions should fit into the wider study of society, which is what LSE does. So it was interesting.
What did you think of the students? What was it like teaching the students?
Gosh, I was mainly teaching undergrads then, and they were nice, smart British students. They felt I didn't feel much older than them. Those were the days. The main thing I taught, following on from my PhD, was where social psychology moves into media and communication. And one of the tricky things about teaching media and communication is you need to have kind of shared common knowledge with people. So in those days, I could talk about BBC News or Coronation Street or the shows that we'd all seen on primetime TV. Now we have to teach media very differently because we have much more international students and the media are much more globalised. But then it felt like a rather kind of privileged, comfortable, small world in a way.
Did that feeling also transcend into being with your colleagues?
Well, the Department of Social Psychology then was a place in a kind of transition because it was a bit, a bit kind of backward-looking in what it had been and what it was trying to hold on to at a time, one can now see, of a huge change both in LSE and in the university sector more broadly. So it was quite a small department, and there were a lot of departments at LSE it took me forever to discover, it wasn't even very clear where to see people except in the senior dining room, which then was a place of men in suits, and women thought twice and took a deep breath before walking in there, even in 1990, or might find someone to go in with. So the larger school was a little more amorphous and didn't always feel a very friendly place, felt quite competitive and kind of competitive within the departments. But there were some interesting things happening then. So we were also starting the Gender Institute around that time, and that drew from a number of different departments and felt like a kind of exciting movement. And then after a few years, I began the media and communication program, and that also drew from a number of different departments and felt like another kind of... So it was the kind of beginning of interdisciplinarity, really, even though everyone was in their somewhat mutually competitive, separate disciplinary spaces.
And tell me a little bit about how you were involved in starting the media and communications program.
I think there are a number of reasons why we started that programme. We started it... the Department of Social Psychology had a very fearsome and significant figure who'd begun that department, Hilda Himmelweit, who I hope someone has done an oral history interview about, because she was a really kind of key figure in a number of things. But she had... drawn the attention in this country of social psychologists to the growing importance of the media in the early 1960s. And then nothing very much happened except Tom Nossiter in the Department of Government and a number of his colleagues were very interested in how media were becoming more important in political processes. But still, there wasn't very much happening at LSE by comparison, for example, with the States, where communication was probably by then already the biggest field. So if I think about LSE then, in a small department, hoping to grow, in an institution that was really interested in fostering different relations among the disciplines and also kind of looking to grow and modernise, media and communication seemed like kind of quite an interesting and exciting development. And what I first did was proposed a master's degree joint between social psychology and government. And we started with a small group of 20 students and no resources at all. And it was in 2003, so it was 10 years after we began the master's, we formed the department. And it was quite a rapid period of growth, but it wasn't a period of growth. It wasn't a process of growth that LSE necessarily put its enthusiasm and resources behind from the start. So it was quite an embattled process, but I was young and keen and full of good intentions.
So looking back over your 25 years here, what would you say were the main challenges? Was that one of the challenges trying to get this department off the ground?
For me, that has been the kind of defining activity of my kind of, you know, if I think what have I contributed at LSE? Yes, introducing that field of study, finding the other people who are also interested in media, galvanising some kind of direction and common understanding, or at least space for debate. That was key. The other challenges at LSE, I'm sure others have talked about, but it's a very peculiar institution trying to stay at the top of a very fast-moving, international, high-pressure space. But for me, I mean, I think making the media communication program and then department work and I was much less centrally involved in the Gender Institute, but that was also very kind of significant in the 1990s as something that... And then all kinds of other things developed, and you can see the European Institute Development Studies. I mean, LSE began then doing lots of new kinds of interdisciplinary structures, but there weren't so many then.
So how has your post changed over the years in terms of your teaching, in terms of life?
There are kind of structural changes. So I said I began teaching mainly British undergraduates. When we formed the Department of Media and Communication, we were graduate only, and since then we've made periodic requests to include undergraduates as well, and the school has not seen undergraduate programs now in the present climate as economically viable, and there are probably some kind of historic intellectual doubts about the field, so we've also been subject to all kinds of views, sometimes fair, sometimes less fair, about the merits of the field and the quality of the theory and so on. So as a result, I teach a lot of very multinational student body, master's level teaching, which I absolutely love. And it has made me had to rethink my field and what I could bring, because people don't necessarily even know what the BBC is. They certainly don't know what Coronation Street is. So, you know, everything has to be... It makes the teaching much more student-centred, because you need to start with wherever people are rather than starting with where you thought the important things in the textbooks were or in the literature. Other changes in my role, I suppose eventually I got promoted, so I could spend more time defining my research agenda and what I thought were the important priorities for research rather than struggling to find space to survive.
Over the time here, what do you think has been like the main highlights for you, the things that have really stuck out, not necessarily academic, but just being here at LSE, the things that really stuck out in your memory as one of the highlights?
High points of being here. There are moments when I do love the moments when people come together across the different departments in a kind of spirit of enthusiasm and will to make something happen. And I think when LSE, those moments come, LSE is really good because you discover your colleagues in the other departments are fantastic and people really can make something happen. And so that sense of the school as a place where a lot of things that happen are not planned for, but they happen because it's a very intense and excellent group of people, rather, you know, sharing a rather small space. So I do think around forming the Department of Media and Communications, it was a fantastic moment. Getting the Gender Institute off the ground, that was a fantastic moment. A lot of these things were actually coincided with Tony Giddens as director. I mean, for me, but for others as well. And there was something about the vision that he brought. So if I think about the kind of directors that I've worked under, that was the moment when I think there was a very positive discussion of interdisciplinary new ideas, LSE being part of an intellectual discourse that was really transnational and fast-moving and felt like people were reading the big books and talking about the big ideas. And I think, you know, I'm talking from the point of view of what are sometimes called the littler departments. So the littler departments have that feeling. I don't honestly know what they were thinking in the Department of Economics or Law, but the littler departments were very happy to have this new kind of dialogue and discourse around late modernity. So that was exciting.
Have you been involved in any sort of recreational or social activities with the staff at LSE?
No. I go to the White Horse often. Does that count?
Describe to me what happens at the White Horse.
What happens at the White Horse is that colleagues go and pack themselves into a tiny, weeny pub on campus, which is quite old. I think it is quite old. And didn't always belong to the LSE. So there was a bit of whispering in corridors when LSE bought the two pubs. But I think it's, I think back to my idea. When this place works well, it works because people want to talk to each other. And so pubs are a place where people talk to each other. So I do a lot of hanging out in the pub with my colleagues and we have a beer and we say what we think. That's fantastic. What else? I always mean to join the choir, but I haven't. My daughter went to the nursery here.
Cool. Oh, can you tell me a little bit about that?
So it's the funny little building that's now... I don't even know what that building is called. The Island Site. It's called the Island Site. It's covered... Oh, sorry, it's over there somewhere. It's currently covered in scaffolding. It's a very, very small Victorian building. Yeah, so she's now 22 and she came there from the age of 1 to 3, something like that, or 0 to 2. She might even have come when she was just born. That was a slightly different LSE, so that was... Then I saw my colleagues have children. And we all struggled in. There are very few people of whom bringing a child to the LSE nursery is an easy thing. It means you've spent an hour or an hour and a half battling on the tube and having men in briefcases swing their briefcase into your baby's face and people going, tut, tut, why is she doing this? But that was the option, so that's what I did.
Just because a lot of people that we've interviewed have been gentlemen, please can you tell me a little bit about what it's like to be like a working mother here at LSE?
Well, so I'm the generation, I'm 55, I'm the generation who didn't get any maternity leave for my first child because I was at Oxford and they'd not even heard of it. So in one sense, everything is completely fantastic here because you do get good maternity leave and they do understand about more or less about working parents. And actually, I think over the time I've been here, those 25 years, the discourse really has shifted from working mothers to working parents. It's not there in all departments. It's not there as well as it should be. I think our department has done that quite well. Mind you, the other peculiar thing about our department is there was a point when I was head of department where we had 4 professors in a group of 12 and they were all women. So we were a pretty kind of structurally unusual department. And as head of department, I was very conscious of doing just those little things like moving the research seminars to lunchtime so that everyone could go and you didn't do your kind of interesting intellectual things after hours when the nursery had said, pick up your kid. So I think when I compare LSE to a number of institutions, I think it is become quite self-conscious and reflexive, but it's I don't hear that from every department, and I don't think it's equally good everywhere. You know, we study inequality, we study gender relations, we study the way in which the workplace should empower people. We could be even better, but we there is it's not hard to point to a kind of reflexive discourse that says, you know, I want to raise this not because I've got a problem, but because the institution isn't supporting me right.
Do you feel that it's also easier for female academics to achieve equality at LSE than perhaps other institutions?
Well, when I look at the statistics, I think that's probably not the case. So, and you'd have to compare LSE with other social science faculties, I think, because social science does create a particular gender mix. I don't think we're... Yeah, and there I think there's a way to go.
This is a silly little question, but I've asked everybody, so... do you have a favourite place on campus?
I think that shifts. Right now, the campus is all being dug up and is complete chaos. So, my favourite place has probably for a long time has been since I was a professor, has probably been my office. That's the place where I get in and I breathe a sigh of relief and I have my favourite rug on the floor and all my books and a painting by my daughter. But right now, we're moving, the whole department's moving. So, I'm losing that. We're going up into a tower and I'm moving into an office half the size. And so I had to throw away a lot of accumulated stuff. St Clement's, right above the Waterstones, looking out on the nice naked men on the old building, on the frieze. Favourite places, you know, I quite like the senior dining room, especially since they improved the food and it's now got a better mix of people and you are allowed to go in there in your jeans and there are women in there. And it has a good feeling of... people are friendly, you can bump into people, you can catch up with people. I like the White Horse, as I've already said. I feel like I spent a lot of time here not noticing Lincoln's Inn Fields right next door. And I don't know if it's the change of the cafe and the start, or I've started kind of enjoying that as LSE does have a bit of green space. The toilets are all dreadful everywhere. Places I don't like. Most of the St Clement's building is really tatty. Yeah, favourite places. I think I love the fact that it feels very enclosed, but literally 2 minutes and you're on the Aldwych or in Covent Garden or up in Holborn.
Can you tell me a little bit about the changes over the years to your job? And the jobs, the careers of the people that you work with, in terms of technology in the last 25 years, and while at LSE?
I can't exactly remember when everyone started using email all the time, but I do vividly remember arriving at work as this young lecturer, and I would look in my pigeonhole because my head of department would have dictated a memo to his secretary and she would have printed it out and put it in the pigeonhole and it would say, Sonia, come and see me. And I would receive it like, you know, is this a summons because I've been bad? Is this dreadful? And or is it just, you know, wanted to say, great, your new article's out. So there was something very terrifying about pigeonholes and having to check them and had he. And he, for quite a long time, when email came in, he would then dictate his emails to a secretary who would then type them up and then print out his emails off the computer and give them back to him. So I do remember all of those days. So technology has, what has it done? It's pinned us all to our desks. I was figuring, I have no idea what the norms are, but I was figuring I'd probably get 100 to 150 emails a day, and I write between 50 and 100, and it feels like too much. And recently I started tweeting about a year ago, and now that takes up time as well. And I tweet only for work, and the emails are 99% for work. So that all feels quite like it actually ties me to my desk, and there's a lot of organising and filing and answering the latest thing rather than the important thing. But at the same time, what I mainly do at LSE is I work in or I coordinate international research networks, and I cannot imagine how I'd have done that 30 years ago. So the main thing I do is over the last 10 years I've been coordinating a network of 150 researchers in 25 or 30 countries, and we are in constant contact, and we only have money to meet once or twice a year, and I can't see how I'd have done it otherwise. So I'm sure it's made us possible to be much more international, and yeah, so that's quite exciting.
You're so succinct with your answers. You're so good with your answers.
Am I? Oh, I can.
Maybe it's really hard.
Maybe that's because I'm in media and communication. Maybe do people ramble? Yeah.
Yes, very much so. They're very good at communicating. That's why I'm like.
How interesting. I think I learned. Okay, so maybe that's another question. I mean, in the last 5 years, a lot of people have put a recording device in front of me and wanted to interview me, and that seems to be the way that we get our messages out. Not normally asking about me, though occasionally, but quite often asking what is my message for policymakers or what have I found in my research. And maybe one just learns to communicate. You know, I was taught originally to write in very long-winded, heavily formulaic, highly abstract, passive tense prose. With a very poor readability index, and you didn't do very much of it. You'd produce an article every 6 months or something. And now, you know, thank God I write an article sometimes, because it's, can I do an interview? Can I do a podcast? Would I join a webinar? Have I tweeted this? Can I write a blog post for someone else's? So it's like one thing you work on now is disseminated in so many ways using all the modern media, with the result that what we have is cacophony, not more understanding, because everyone is blogging and tweeting and posting, and so
market is saturated.
The market is saturated, and no one, I mean, the irony, it really is an irony, that also 25, 30 years ago, if you wanted to research a new topic, you would go to the library and you would do a keyword search. And originally, you do it by going through file index cards, when the librarian sort of catalogued things for you and coded them in various ways. Then you could do it on the computer, but you'd still use the databases. And now it seems to me that people tweet, I'm going to write a paper about, anyone know anything good on? Three people will tell them about an article, and they won't. So this is a bit of a... Yeah. Old academic rant now. What happened to proper literature reviews and academic standards?
Have you found over the years that any of the colleagues that you've worked with, or anybody that, any of the faculty that you worked with, have become, have really inspired you, or have become friends, or have really changed the way you looked at your subject?
Hmm. Well, there are, yes. It's not a simple thing to say. There are lots of colleagues that I know and talk to whose work I probably don't really read or don't really get. And there are many more people outside the LSE who, you know, if I were going to say these are the key sources I draw on, or this is the tradition I put myself in, it's usually outside. And sometimes, you know, when you form a new department, you do a lot of kind of soul-searching about what are we for and what's our view and how we're different from other departments. So we did have some quite kind of reflexive thinking about whether we should be drawing particularly on each other's work and somehow develop a school of thought that would be LSE Media School of Thought or the social psychologists, we did that as well. And there it was easier, but that was because social psychology as a field was imploding and dying and all kinds of crazy things were happening. So social psychology at LSE is almost the last game in town now. So there are colleagues whose work I have drawn upon, but I think what I really value about the LSE is that when I sit down to talk to somebody, we have a fantastic conversation about ideas. It's not necessarily that I would say I'm working in their tradition or I'm an advocate of their view, but people are so well read and so debating the trends of the moment that, and when I want to find somebody, so for example, in the last 10 years, I've been writing about, working particularly on children and young people, and the LSE doesn't have any institutional structure for organising, bringing people together around that. So I just started a series of termly lunches. Anyone interested in children and young people, let's meet once a term and talk about something. And, I don't know, 20, 25 people came, and instantly there was this fantastic conversation with people from all these different disciplines, very glad to have that opportunity, very ready to make that space. So I think that's what I, yeah. So it's in that sense that I draw on my colleagues. Well, now I'm doing work about children's rights online, and never have I been more aware of the complexities of the law about which I know nothing. But I can go to the law department and say, my God, I'm sorry, I don't even know what a contract is or what kind of rights I'm talking about. Can you help? And there is this fantastic wealth of knowledge that is kind of generously given.
So what you're saying is there's a resource of people willing to, like, exchange ideas, willing to talk to you.
And that idea that the school is, I don't know if every university says it's bigger than the sum of its parts. I know that it's said a lot around here. I think that is really true, and what I find depressing about the university sector as a whole, and sometimes this institution, is the way in which funding and management structures put people back into their disciplinary boxes. And I'm not saying I want everyone to be one big conversation, because students need disciplinary homes, and actually we all develop our careers within more or less within disciplinary homes, but I also think it would be good if there were even more ways of, you know, they're not recognised, those conversations. Someone generously gives you their time, and that was just a gift. Thank you. But you repay it with somebody else, but it's not visible. There's something slightly odd about that.
It's not. You can't really measure it.
Yeah, and not that I would actually want to measure it. I would like it to be, I would like people very consciously not to put management barriers in the way of it by putting departments in buildings or letting the place get too big that we can't bump into each other in the senior dining room or whatever.
That kind of leads me on to my next question, which is, what do you think the future of LSE will be?
Well, it will be hugely dictated by the future of the academy writ large. So there is a limited degree, you know, there are limits on how much LSE can be self-determining. And the future of the academy seems to be a place of withdrawn public funding, and the academy sadly becoming part of growing inequality rather than, as many had hoped, the chance of alleviating inequality. And LSE is being forced to play a very international game, which has benefits in terms of quality and networks and the flow of ideas. But, you know, when I hear, I don't know, I think, there are kind of things to worry about as well. So when I hear colleagues in some departments talking about international markets for jobs or pressures on market pressures on salaries, which force apart, which create a real split in the school between those who are paid market rates and those who are paid public servant kinds of rates. I mean, I think some of those things are just going to split us, and I think it's not clear that the school has got enough reserves. We're not like those American, you know, we're trying to play like the American universities, and we haven't got the billions of dollars in the foundation, in the bank. So it has always felt a bit on edge, a bit like we're pulling off something that we can't be sure we're going to sustain. So there's quite a lot of anxiety around.
Do you worry that the smaller departments that are more specialised but attract less students, do you worry about the future of those departments? Compared to, say, like,
yes,
the management department?
Yes, I do. So can we have LSE without a sociology department or an anthropology department? I have no idea what the student numbers are at the moment, but I think, you know, they're not... They couldn't expand 10 times their size and become like management or economics. So this is actually, right now, an interesting moment because it's when the government has said institutions can expand as they want to if there is student demand. Where LSE can physically expand to and whether the money coming in is going to be enough to pay for very expensive real estate and rather high salaries, I don't know. So I would love there to be a stronger discourse of what the LSE is that encompasses a range of social science departments and less talk about cross subsidies and cost effectiveness and maximising income and all of that. So yes, I worry.
So I've kind of asked you... Oh, actually, my question I asked you. Were you involved in any sort of academic boards or any sort of staff boards, staff meetings?
What have I done? I was on the first when... oh, my God, now I'm going to forget names. Adrian, who ran everything. What's he called? The secretary.
I know who you're talking about.
Yes. We started up the agenda committee for the academic board, and I was on the first iteration of that, and that was quite interesting because that was when there was a kind of lot of... So that must have been early 90s, a lot of rethinking about what academic board should be. An academic board is just such a... I don't know any other university that has the equivalent of the academic board, which I know is constantly under review, but does feel like the academics have a place to make some important decisions. So being on the agenda committee of that was a kind of early, for me, insight into some of the political shenanigans that could go on. That was interesting. I served for a while with on the committee that decided who would be the governors and prize winners and, oh my God, what is that? Who got the honorary degrees?
Honorary.
Yeah, sorry, I can't remember what that's called either. I know I was on it for quite a long time. And that was, is she called Joan Poole?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She kind of was the administrator for that. That was interesting because that was a kind of opportunity to think, who are LSE's friends beyond the school and who can come in and sit on the governing body and who should be recognised and who should be engaged and involved. That was very interesting. Otherwise, I've taken my turn on committees when asked, but mainly been focused on starting a new department and getting on with my research.
So you've basically answered all the questions I had for you. Before we finish, or is there anything you feel that I haven't asked you about and that I haven't, going back over everything that we've talked about, is there anything you feel like that hasn't been addressed or anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to say?
No, I don't think so. I think I touched on lots of things, and what I don't know is how it's going to dovetail with everything else. I hope there's going to be some clever cataloguing of these interviews so that everything gets linked up. No.